Well, good morning. It's good to be with you, and I'd like to invite you to go to 1 Timothy chapter 6 once again this morning, 1 Timothy and chapter 6. We'll be looking specifically at verses 6 to 10 in 1 Timothy chapter 6. I think you know that we live in a day. There are many descriptors for this day, this age of time, this season in our society that could be described from different angles. But if you think about the economic angle, one way to say it is that we live in the day of the side hustle, or what's also been called the gig economy. And there are all kinds of ways that you and I can make some extra cash, a lot of which don't even require you to leave your house. All you need is a computer and an internet connection. Maybe you have tried some of these side hustles that I found listed online. I won't take a poll. But you can get paid to test apps or to take surveys. You can post affiliate links on your blog or get ad revenue from your YouTube channel. You can sell crafts on Etsy. You can use your second language to do freelance translation work. And if you're willing to put in a little more effort that may require you to leave the house, here are some of the other things you can do. You can start a dog walking business, or sell unused gift cards, or rent out your spare bedroom through Airbnb. You can trade in your old smartphone, drive for Uber or Lyft, make deliveries for DoorDash, sign up to be a mystery shopper to test customer experience, or even put your drone to work to take aerial videos for people. And I was looking at that list, and I forwarded it to my wife because today's her birthday. I'm not sure what the connection is, but these seem like really interesting ideas. Everybody wants to get ahead financially. Everybody's out to make a buck, whether it's a young adult with a few of those side hustles or a tech startup with some exciting new app or a global investment firm. Everybody wants to turn a profit. And that's not necessarily wrong. But one of the problems is when your money-making scheme is religion. That's no longer a scheme. We would call that a scam. And that's the problem that Paul has been dealing with here in 1 Timothy chapter 6. We're coming back to this chapter this morning, and this is a part two of a little two-part series that has been entitled for us, Faithful to Godly Contentment. Faithful to Godly Contentment. And last week, Dr. Meyer, he did part one. He dealt with verses 3 to 5. And those verses, if you remember, they focused on a kind of false teaching that was apparently infiltrating the church at Ephesus, and that Paul was instructing Timothy to deal with very decisively, to correct it. And what that teaching was about, you can sum it up in a short statement, and Paul says it there at the end of verse 5. The idea that godliness is a means of gain. Or we could also say that godliness is a means of turning a profit. And today we do associate that idea with the prosperity gospel. And last week, Dr. Meyer did a great job of expounding how it is that this passage corrects that form of false teaching. When we come to the passage for today, actually the text takes a little bit of a surprising turn. Look with me at verse 6, and it begins with the word but. So as you encounter that conjunction, you're naturally expecting that Paul is going to give us a contrast with his previous point. He's going to go in a totally different direction. And yet what he goes on to say is that godliness actually is a means of gain. It's a little surprising that he would put it in those terms. It almost seems like he's adopting the wording right from his description of the false teachers, and he says godliness actually is a means of gain. In fact, he says it's a means of great gain. Or as one translation put it, religion does yield high dividends. Now, Paul is not contradicting himself. He is taking up those words about the false teachers, but he is giving a fresh and a positive meaning to the concept. And one way we know that he is advancing the thought and not contradicting himself is that he does add the condition to godliness, that this is godliness specifically with contentment. And we need to think about what the word contentment means. That term was commonly used by Stoic philosophers to convey the ideal that they were pursuing in their worldview. And that was the possibility that you could actually come to live totally independently of the circumstances around you. They were talking about what we would call self-sufficiency, where you have come to develop such control over your thoughts and over your feelings that nothing outside of you is able to alter your state of mind. Nothing is able to affect your internal sense of calm. And their effort was by sheer willpower to achieve that sense of calm, to become what we might describe as unflappable. I've always liked that word, unflappable. Paul actually uses their term, and yet he is not encouraging the sort of self-reliance that they were given over to. What he's talking about, he actually describes a little bit more in detail in a passage that probably all of us could quote, and that's Philippians chapter 4, verses 11 to 13. Remember, that is when he was describing how the Philippians had been such a blessing to him in providing his financial needs. But then he turns around and says in verse 11, I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. And the word there is of the same root as the one we're seeing here in 1 Timothy. And then he says this, I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. And so, in essence, Paul actually has arrived at what the Stoics wanted, where his circumstances, whether it might be plenty or hunger, either way, whatever the circumstance is, I'm okay. I'm at rest in my heart. The question is, how did he get there? And the answer to that question is a passage certainly we could quote. It is verse 13 of Philippians 4, I can do all things through Christ, through him who strengthens me. And he's making the point that he didn't arrive at this peace just through willpower or through some kind of psychological trick or just some kind of humanistic way of overcoming his emotions. It was actually something that the Lord Jesus Christ ministered to Paul, settling his heart to the degree that Paul was actually communing with Christ and relying upon him. And that attitude was actually the opposite of the attitude of the false teachers that Paul's dealing with here in 1 Timothy. They were always craving for more possessions. They were thinking that if I could just get a little bit more, or maybe a lot more, I would be okay, I would be well, I would be at peace. And Paul says, actually, there's a way to develop peace no matter what your level of material possessions is. But there's another difference between what Paul is saying and what those false teachers were saying. And it's in defining what he means by the word gain or profit. Remember, the statement is, godliness with contentment is great gain. What is this gain or this profit that he's talking about? I found it helpful that he's actually alluded to this earlier in this letter. So I want to read to you from 1 Timothy chapter 4. And verse 7 says, have nothing to do with irreverent silliness, rather train yourself for godliness. And then he makes this statement, for while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life that is to come. And that passage is talking about the same subject, godliness, same terminology. And he contrasts the value of godliness, this God-word orientation in life. He contrasts that with the value of physical exercise. He doesn't deny that physical exercise is profitable. He says it does yield some benefits, but the benefits would have to be of the nature of what physical exercise is. It's something temporal. It is something earthly. It is something physical or material. When you talk about godliness, you're talking about something of a different nature. This is not talking about your physical advancement, though there may be spillover blessings in that area. The focus of godliness is on the spiritual benefits. And he says that those benefits are good for this life. They're going to be spiritual profit. There's going to be spiritual profit for you now on this earth, but also, and more importantly, in the life to come. These things are going to last for all eternity. And that is the kind of profit that when Paul comes to chapter 6, he is developing. He is pulling on that idea, and now he's taking it further. He is talking about not material profit like the false teachers were, but he's talking about the spiritual profit of godliness with contentment. At this point, Paul isn't just going after the false teachers. He's really making a point that is broadly applicable. It's applicable to Timothy as a minister. It's applicable to believers generally. And it's applicable really to humanity at large. And this is a message that, as it is preached, would perhaps get the attention of even unbelievers, that they might think about eternity. The natural question is, with all of this focus on spiritual profit, what is it that we get? What is the profit? What is the spiritual gain that we can come to enjoy through godliness and contentment? It's one thing to make the statement, this is really profitable. But when you ask, what is the profit, that is exactly what the rest of the passage is going to fill out for us. Notice that verse 7 begins with the word for, or because. And there, Paul is elaborating on what he had just said, or he is giving a reason for what he just said. He is answering the question, why, or maybe you could also put it, how or in what way is godliness with contentment great gain? Why is this so profitable? What do I get out of it? That's the question that we want to answer this morning. And I'd like to summarize Paul's development here really in two answers or two categories of answers. And the first one of them, as we look at 7 to 8, I could put it this way. Godliness with contentment is great gain because it aligns your life with reality. Let me say it again. Godliness with contentment is so profitable because it aligns your life with reality. You may have had the experience of trying to help somebody that you would describe as delusional. Maybe not in the technical sense, but it was still like in that person's way of thinking, they were living in a world that doesn't exist. Maybe they'd been sucked into some conspiracy theory and it colored how they viewed everything. And it was all they wanted to talk about. But it was not a world that could be demonstrated to be factual or actual. Or maybe they just had an exaggerated perception of their abilities and their success. They were delusional about how good they were at something. Maybe they thought someone was romantically interested in them, and that wasn't the case either. They were delusional when it comes to relationships. And you might say about those people that they're living in a dream world. They're living in a fantasy world. And it is sad when somebody's mindset and behavior, they don't align with reality. I believe that what Paul is saying here is that a materialistic life is a delusional life. It's a fantasy world. It makes more out of the present physical realm than is actually there. The solution to that is contentment. When you nurture Christian contentment, you actually end up living in a way that is consistent with the way things actually are. What Paul does at this point is to highlight for us two realities of life that contentment aligns you with. The first of them is in verse 7, and it's the reality that you and I are independent from our material possessions. We are independent from our material possessions. That's a way of stating what he's getting at when he says, "For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world." Paul seems to be alluding to the words of Job, who had such an exemplary attitude after the first wave of satanic attacks when all his children were taken away. And he says in Job 1:21, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Or maybe he was thinking of Ecclesiastes 5, verses 13 to 15. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand to leave to his son. And then verse 15 follows up by saying, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go, and what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? You didn't bring anything other than yourself into the world, and as you depart, that's all that you have. When I meditated on that, I thought about a recent experience that my wife, my daughter, and I had as we were traveling down to Puerto Rico for spring break a couple weeks ago. And I found this great deal on tickets through one of these discount companies. And they have ways to get your attention and draw you in. And then you come to find out there are all these hidden fees. And I knew more or less what I was getting into, but it really was a great deal. Until we started thinking about our luggage. And I tried to weigh the luggage. I thought it was within the parameters. We get to the airport. The suitcases are overweight. Now what are we going to do? We're going to pay another $80 or so. It's just a ridiculous amount. So what do? You start really evaluating how much do I really need this thing? And you start shuffling things into different places. Actually, on the way back, we got a little smarter, and we put our shoes and some of the heavier items in the carry-on. Of course, they're still on the same plane. What difference it makes, I don't know. But financially, we were able to scheme a little bit to make it work, but it was still too heavy, probably because we bought some things down there. So we're literally at the airport coming back, and my wife has thrown away her hairspray. She's getting rid of other items like that that were weighing her down. Maybe that gives us a little bit of an idea. You've got to strip down in order to travel. Now, thankfully, that was just a little bit of a stripping down. When it comes to death, you strip down to nothing. And at death, it's like we have to shed everything except for ourselves, even the clothes on our own back. And we understand that the funeral people might dress us up for our viewing to make us look nice. But by that point, our spirit has already departed. And whatever clothes we have here makes no difference. We've gone into the next life without it. Now, the ancient people of Egypt, they thought that they could take their possessions into the afterlife, which is why the pyramids were stuffed full with the belongings of the Pharaoh. But unless you're into some religion along those lines, most people understand the fact that Paul is getting at here, that you come into the world with nothing, you can't take anything out. People know that mentally. But materialism has not thought through to the implications of that obvious fact. And here is the implication. If your life exists independently of your material possessions, then it is foolish to live as though those possessions are somehow the key to a worthwhile life or a satisfying life. This is separate from who you are. It's independent of your identity as a human being. And so it is foolish to live as though somehow what you really need to have a truly satisfying life is all of the accumulation of this stuff. This is the point Jesus was making back in Luke 12:15. He said, take care and be on guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Hopefully that's clear, but somebody might still say, yes, it's true, we enter without our things, we exit without our things, but in between those two points, we actually do need material things in order to stay alive and in order to make use of life. And Paul's going to deal with that as he goes on and basically is going to say, that's correct. You actually do need material things in order to survive and to make use of life, but it's all in the definition of what you actually need for that to happen. And so here is the second reality of life that contentment helps you to be aligned with, and that is the simple point in verse 8 that basic provisions are sufficient. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. That is such a difficult truth to accept in our culture. You and I are so used to having all kinds of things and relying upon all kinds of things that are not actual needs that we really do have a hard time distinguishing between needs and extras. And Paul defines what the needs are. He says, first of all, food, which you maybe could take as a metonym for whatever is essential for physical sustenance, could perhaps include what you need for health and normal development. Second, there is clothing, which is a word that could also be translated covering and could be understood again more broadly as referring to, as including shelter over you. But that's basically it, physical sustenance and covering. Now, the Lord often, in his grace, he gives us many things beyond that. And Ecclesiastes, for example, teaches that we can enter into those things and enjoy them, even to the glory of God. In fact, Paul's going to uphold that as well later in this chapter. He goes on in verses 17 to 19, and he's going to exhort the people in the church that are rich. He's going to tell them, yes, you ought to be generous with your wealth and not live for your wealth, but he stops short of telling them that they have to give up their riches altogether. In fact, he says in verse 17 that God richly provides us with everything to enjoy. That's a broader statement than what he's making in our text here. But the point he's making here is that we don't actually need all the extras. So if our identity or our sense of wellness is defined by those extras, here again, we are not living according to reality. If my attitude is, I cannot live without those extras, I am living in a make-believe world, not in the real world. And here's the kind of spirit that the Apostle Paul is encouraging. It's like what the writer of Proverbs 30 prayed, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is Yahweh? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. That kind of contented spirit is a reality check that keeps us from living in ways that deny the basic nature of human existence. And Paul's point is, here's one of the great advantages, some of the great gain of contentment. And then he goes to the second reason in verses 9 to 10. And the second reason is, godliness with contentment is great gain because it protects you from spiritual danger. It protects you from spiritual danger. And as you read those verses, you find that he develops that point with language that is emphatic and that is graphic. And he tells you what is the spiritual danger that he's so concerned about with materialism. There are actually two of them, and one of them leads quickly to the other. So the first of them is at the beginning of verse 9. It is the danger of sinful desires. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmless desires. Notice first that he is talking about those who desire riches. It's your will to do this, to seek this as your ambition. And that helps us understand that he's not talking about people that right now are rich necessarily. That statement applies just as much to poor people as it does to rich people. In fact, maybe you could say even more, because often the people who really want to be rich are the people who aren't at the moment. And notice as well how he describes the danger. He talks about falling into temptation. You don't start out intending to give in to the temptation. You are overtaken by it. He also talks about a snare, which is like a trap used to capture an animal unawares. And that speaks of the deceitfulness of materialism, that it exaggerates the benefits and it minimizes the risks, and you end up duped. He speaks as well of many senseless and harmful desires. It is irrational. It doesn't make sense. I read a story about a rich man who was speeding down a mountain road on a snowy day, and he was in a brand new sports car, and he lost control, and his car starts to go careen over the edge. He's able to jump out right at the last minute, but his arm got caught in the hinge of the door and actually snapped his arm right below his shoulder. And he survived. And here he is on the edge of the mountain. He's looking down, and somebody drives up and tries to help him. And he's looking down, and out of shock, he doesn't realize what's happened to him. And he's just like, my sports car. And the guy who showed up said, buddy, you've got more to worry about than your car. Have you looked at your arm? We got to get you some help. And he looks at his arm and he says, oh no, my Rolex. Irrational desires. Now that's a ridiculous story, but maybe not as ridiculous as the way people can think and act when they are obsessed with financial profit. And that brings us to the final danger, the ultimate danger that contentment protects us from, and that is the danger of apostasy. Here again, we don't have time for this, but there's a lot of graphic language when he says that plunge people or sink people into ruin and destruction. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Through this craving, some have wandered away from the faith and have literally impaled themselves with many pangs. And when he says all kinds of evils proceed from this, what sorts of things could he be talking about? It doesn't take a lot of imagination to come up with a list. Envy, lying, fraud, tax evasion, blackmail, gambling addiction, stealing, neglect of your family responsibilities, the breakdown of your marriage, the oppression of the vulnerable, relational tension that leads to violence or even murder. Think about some of the things that have been in the headlines, even within the last month here in our state. And that list of evils is bad enough, but it's actually a list of short-term results. The really bad ones are the long-term ones where people wander from the faith and they pierce themselves through with many pangs. And you wonder who Paul was thinking about. Maybe this is the explanation for Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom he mentions as making shipwreck of their faith back in chapter 1. Maybe he is remembering that the Gospel of Luke describes the Pharisees as lovers of money. And he was thinking perhaps of some of his former colleagues in Judaism. The point is that there is something eternally at stake when it comes to the love of money. And so we do well to ask ourselves a question, how would I know that I love money? It sounds like such a serious thing. How would I know that I love money? I leave you with these questions. These are questions not totally original with me, but very helpful to apply this passage. I know I love money when I meditate on it or talk about it with more fervency than I meditate on the Lord and the things of God. When I make my choices based primarily on what will give me financial advantage instead of on what pleases God. I know I love money when I ignore or hurt people because of my financial pursuits. When I don't sincerely thank God for the material blessings I have. I know I've come to love money when I am deeply disappointed or paralyzed if I lose some of those extras. Or when I'm willing to go into unwise debt in order to get something I want. And definitely if I'm willing to transgress the laws of God in order to make money. And that issue of money really is the focus, but I don't want to miss the opportunity here to say that these principles and these questions apply to discontentment about anything, really. You may not struggle with the love of money, but you may be discontent or have wrong priorities in relation to other things like relationships or success or recognition or popularity or just comfort. It doesn't have to be specifically material possessions. And as we wrestle with these things, this passage is urging us to renew our commitment to Christian contentment. Maybe you've heard this classic definition of that by the Puritan Jeremiah Burroughs. He says it is that sweet, inward, quiet, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. And I pray that the Lord will use this passage to work in my heart and in your heart more and more of that sweet and gracious spirit. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the instruction of your word. May you make us sensitive to this issue. May you grow us in our contentment. And we thank you for correcting our thinking and warning us and protecting us through the teaching of your word. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.